Chö means to cut. And you visualize that you cut your body as a way of offering. You're not really cutting your body. What you're cutting is your ego, or what you identify with most. And that's why the body is what we're using as the metaphor of cutting. We usually talk about ourselves, define ourselves with our body. We say, you know, it's my hand. And usually when they say, how are you? You always think of the body. Even in Tibetan, you know, when we say, how are you? Kuzu debo imbe. Also, ku, it's body. So body is very much identified to person. And so the idea of cutting through the body is really cutting through your ego.
It sounds to me rather creepy what you're telling me about cutting up your own body, and you have to visualize that. And I even read that you don't do that in your bedroom, but you're going to graveyards and whatever.
The reason of going to graveyards is to face your fears, because part of cutting through your ego is cutting through your own fears. Before you actually go to graveyards, you practice for at least 3 years in a peaceful place, whether it's your bedroom or more. We usually would use our altar space or temple to practice. So you train yourself, you familiarize yourself with the practice with the idea of visualizing how to cut your body and cut your ego, and then yes, you go to a place that creates fear as you do that.
But why would you do that?
Well, first of all, in a way, we're attaching to external things, including the body, as a way of getting out of being in touch with ourselves. And so, in a way, by being able to cut through all of this, it's a way of coming home, if you would. It's a way of reconnecting to a deeper aspect of yourself that is beyond the limitations or the illusions, in a more Buddhist word, of external things that shape us. It's a meditative practice of reconnecting to yourself by, on one hand, giving away your identity and even paying off, because part of it is paying off your debts to all beings.
You offer your body, but isn't that a rather dualist exercise? Because what's left is then your mind, or what?
It is a dualist practice at the beginning, and that is because we live in a dualist perception. Eventually, the idea is to go from the dual to the non-dual. The moment that you are visualizing of the cutting of the body and being able to stay in that state of mind beyond that, it becomes a non-dual state. By staying in that state of mind and being able to remain, there's a sense of liberation, not only of your body, but all that is carried by the burdens of identity and our relationships to the world. And so by being without it, it's almost like unification with everything.
You just mentioned that you're sitting on your cushion visualizing this cutting of your flesh and bones. But I thought that you have to do all kinds of things like playing with bones and skulls and making a lot of noise with it.
You don't play with the bones and skulls, although there is a bone instrument, the kungling, which becomes a trumpet. It is actually made of a human thigh bone. It's used as a way of summoning what we call the demons to provoke your fear and then offer the body. And as you do that, you are sitting on your cushion, but you are playing instruments such as a damaru, which is a double-sided drum, and a bell. I actually have a bell here.
It's a copper bell.
Yes. We play it from side to side as we play the drum back to back.
During this ritual.
During different parts of the ritual. So there are parts of the ritual.
So you sit and you have in one hand this bell, in the other hand some bone thing?
On the right hand you have the drum. In the left hand you start with the thigh bone and then you leave the thigh bone and then you use the bell. And then at the end you have the thigh bone again. There are true practices that you're also dancing. I don't do them. I haven't learned it yet.
Okay, but you're going to.
Hopefully. Yes.
I see.
There's many different texts. Actually, I can show you one text of the Chur practice, the one that I translated in my book.
Oh, there's a beautiful silk.
It's a Pecha cover. Pecha is a Tibetan text. This is a cover for it because we consider the text sacred.
Een soort klein tasje van zijde en daar zitten allemaal teksten in op oude papieren. What sort of language is this?
Tibetan. This is Tibetan language and these are done by block print. So you have a wooden block that you carve and then it's printed in that way.
And whose are these fingerprints on it?
The fingerprints are blessings and one is of Shense Lama, a Lama of the Burn tradition of the Tompa Shenrab, the founder of the tradition. So he's of that lineage. And the other one is an interesting woman, her name is Khandro Rinpoche, who I met in my last trip to Tibet. She's considered the emanation or the reincarnation of Kalzang Ma, who's the deity in this particular text. I always carry my text with me, and so when I saw her, I asked her to bless it, and that's the fingerprint.
This is sort of a holy text for you?
Yes, clearly. For us, all the texts that help us in our meditations, which we can think of it in self-transformation, or you can say even sacred transformation, they are sacred in that way, so yes.
What does it say? There's one line here.
This is the name of the text. It says, Yamsab Namkidzo Chen Le, so it means from this text called The Great Treasure of the Profound Sky. And then it says, Lujing Khandro Kechang Shuk. So the text is called The Offering of the Body of the Laughter of the Khandros or the Dakinis, these female enlightened deities.
And what is the role of these texts in this practice? Are you reading them, reciting them?
Yes. There's both. Partly there's an explanation, and then there's the way that you recite them. And so as you do the practice, you would recite the text along with it. Once you learn the practice, you recite it as you play the drum and the bell.
Does it give you a state of trance?
Yeah, it depends on how you define trance. It helps you to be in that state of meditation, yes.
Is it really about cutting or about offering? No, because the thing of chut, if I understand it well, it is that you have to offer your body.
Sure. And in a way, it's both. It all depends from what perspective you're looking at it. There's sometimes that the offering part, it's a kinder way of starting, right? Because what you're doing is offering it to others. First you cut it, then you cook it, then you offer it. And then there's a sense,
sort of carnivoric perspective.
Well, you have to think of the metaphor, and actually in the text it talks about both what we call the white offering and the red offering. And so the white offering, we transform it into nectar, as my teacher Lopun Desi Namdak would say, palatable to all the vegetarian ones. And then
cooking soup of your own flesh and bones.
Exactly. And the other one is actually chopping it, and you know, the text even says, you know, feeding from the flesh, from the bones, from the blood. That would be more for the carnivorous ones. But in any
case, very colorful.
Yes, very colorful. There's also another perspective from which this text comes from, which is the Dzogchen, which means the great completion tradition. It's all about being able to stay in that state of mind. And doesn't matter so much what you're doing with it in terms of offering or not offering or rejecting or not rejecting. It's just being able to cut and be there and just stay in that state of mind.
So in this Dzogchen school, the idea is not to do it for others. I was thinking this offering,
yes,
kind is a Mahayana idea.
Sure. The Mahayana part is very much embedded in it. But the method is slightly different. In the Sutric Mahayana way, what you would do is offer as a way of virtuous quality, leave aside the unvirtuous quality. In Tantra, you would use offering as a generosity, as a way of antidote for your attachment. So in this case, attachment to the body, you cut through it and you cultivate generosity. In the Dzogchen way, the idea is there's no need to leave aside or even to use an antidote. In a way, it's just cutting and being. It's like a snowflake falling in the ocean. The snowflake doesn't make any effort. The ocean doesn't make any effort. And so when you cut, you just stay in that state of mind. That state of mind is also the same for all beings. So yes, it is with that in mind that you're from there trying to help all sentient beings reach the same.
In the offering part, I recognized some Christian familiarity. You know, Christ offered himself for the well-being of mankind.
And many times when I was researching this chur practice, I would think, well, in a way, when Christians would take communion, especially from the Catholic perspective, that the bread is the body. It's not like a reference to the body. And the wine is the blood. It's like, oh, isn't this like a little chur?
I think it is.
There might be more similarities. Maybe that's the next book.
You practice chur yourself. Do you go to the cemeteries?
No, I don't. Traditionally, actually, it was interesting because the cemeteries were not like our cemeteries, where ours are usually not as scary. In the charnel grounds, you would see the bones, you would see the skulls. But we do practice, for example, at night in open areas. So that creates a little bit of that fearful, but no, I have not practiced in charnel grounds, actually.
Apart from your own experiences, where did you conduct your research on this subject? Did you go to Tibet to see those places where they do these things?
My research on this I've done mostly in Nepal and India, mostly because I was looking for where they're practiced now and where I can have access. Tibet has become a very difficult place to go and do this kind of research and even meet the people that do these practices. And so the teachers that I work with are in India and Nepal and in the US. So I work more textually. And then in the monastery in Nepal, I've practiced with their group there, and that's where we would also be at night outside practicing together.
Who put you on this path?
If I look back, my first personal Lama, Yeshe Dorje Rinpoche, was a chur practitioner. He used to travel through 108 cemeteries in Tibet doing this practice, and I was staying in his monastery when I first heard the practice, and I heard it as a melody, really, and that's what really attracted me. That was really the way I got into the practice, and then through the music started to getting involved in the practice and realized how it's much more than music, and how this that you call kind of creepy practice actually became very attractive to me. And then, interesting enough, I met many of my teachers were Chupas too, or practice Chö, such as Namkha Norbu Rinpoche, Tenzin Wangyo Rinpoche, Lopun Tenzin Namdak. And that's how I said, well, maybe I should also see how it's practiced in the Burn tradition and the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah. So you got into theory after.
Exactly. I first went from the music to the practice to the theory.